bit worried about time. I never can time it. It's all from my...
Can I give you 5 minutes
away? Yeah, well, I don't know whether it'll help, but as you saw from my biodiversity essay conference, I struggle. I'm going to try my best.
But you have
And you got everything right, all those details in a row. Thank you. Amazing memory. welcome. I hope you're enjoying the series. So, I'm going to tell you something about the past, where we are now, and what it means for the future. But I'm first and foremost a lover of plants. I'm a botanist, and I know many of you love plants, probably not as much, but probably just as much as I love plants, from the moraes to the lacanalias, to the albucas, the laparousias, the gladioli, the sacred canakis on the right there, the little sugar cans, ornithogalums, the daisies, the amazing colors we have with all the daisies, shapes and sizes, our mesens, our fakies, 1,500 species in the Macquarieland alone, tremendous variety of daisies, our geraniums, our legacy to the world, one of our legacies to the world, to the plant world, geraniums grown all over the world now, our legumes, the Yankee Berend on the bottom right, cancer bush, the flaky's boss on the left, which when animals eat it, they get drunk on the flowers. And our aloes, our beautiful aloes, such as these here, and of course the Cunnyduet aloe variegata from the Macquarieland. So these are just a few plants, just from the Macquarieland region. We have this amazing diversity of plants, over 20,000. Species in South Africa, more than 10% or around 10% of the world's flora, in less than 1% of the land surface area of the world. Tremendous diversity that come together in these wonderful displays, such as these in the Macquarieland, which we like to go and visit and share with our international friends. All the colors, yellows and whites, purples, oranges, that make up communities of plants, all living together, but also most importantly, changing over time. Nothing is static, and it's always changing. And we've known about this flora for a very long time. We've known how special it is, and we've had many people over centuries working on this flora. We know the responsibility we have to look after this flora, and it's thanks to people like Harry Bolus in the top left, who set up the Bolus Library and the Bolus Herbarium, businessman and philanthropist, Rudolf Marloth, Stellenbosch chemist and photographer and dedicated botanist, wrote a major book on the Cape flora. I.B. Paul Evans, the head of what's now Sandby, the first director of what's now Sandby, great photographer, botanist and plant pathologist. Professor Adamson from UCT, who lectured here in the 1920s, and of course Margaret Levins, the wonderful contributor to the Cape flora, and who studied the vegetation of the Cape and contributed so much over so many years, including teaching people like John Acox on the top right, who studied here. John, of course, was a Sax boy, lived in Vredehoek, used to spend his afternoons walking on the slopes of Devil's Peak, and had a phenomenal knowledge of the flora of South Africa, and was taught by Dr. Levins. And more about John Acox later. But not only were these botanists trying to get to grips with this very diverse flora, collect the plants, identify the plants, describe new plants, but they were also trying to get a sense of how this flora is put together. Where do these plants grow? How can we start working with them? How can we define communities, vegetation types, biomes in different regions? And we had a successive number of maps over the years, such as the one you see here by Paul Evans in the 1930s, which tried to define different regions of the country and where different vegetation types might occur. Fieldwork in those days, the very early years, of course, was very different to today. Ox wagon was the main form of transport in the very early years before motorized transport. And then we had vehicles like this, which I wouldn't go very far in. I wouldn't plan a field trip around this vehicle, that's for sure. And even some trips like this, which Paul Evans did in Namibia, using the railway tracks and this, some kind of engine that would take them along the railway tracks, stopping at regular intervals, photographing, collecting, documenting the flora. Very dedicated to understanding the vegetation of the region. And then these wonderful huge, big, luxurious cars that Margaret Levins, in fact, used to drive around in with her husband. Today, of course, it's different. I use a Mazda Wildlife vehicle. Thanks, Mazda Wildlife. It's the most wonderful vehicle. I'm putting a plug in for Mazda Wildlife now. And we have no difficulties like the early botanists. Sometimes I must have wondered what the advantages were of motorized transport in areas like Kimberley, being pulled out by a passing donkey cart through the mud after a rain. But these were real expeditions. Here's Paul Evans in the 1920s, somewhere in the Bushveld. He'd plan a long, extensive month, 6 week long field trip, traveling all over the area in his sort of bus type thing, stopping, getting permission from the landowner, collecting, working, mapping, photographing all day, and sometimes even at night, through the headlights of your vehicle, pressing plants, keeping up to date. This is John Aycox on the bottom right with his mentor, his Swedish mentor, Hafström, on one of their trips in the late 1930s. So this was real expedition time, and must have been a very exciting period to be a botanist in. So some of our very early attempts to map the vegetation of South Africa were rather crude. This is Harry Bolus's map from 1886, but we recognize some of the main components. We see the southwestern region, more or less where we have fynbos today, the Karoo region, more or less defining the succulent Karoo, the Composite region, the daisies, that's more or less the Nama Karoo today, and then the savannas on the east, the tropical region, African region on the east, and then a sort of a here be dragons region, sort of Kalahari, whatever's up there. It's much more complicated. But it was really 1986 that Mike Rutherford and Bobby Westfall developed our biomes map of South Africa. And this has become a major organizing principle for our thinking in South African ecology. It really is the work that we refer to all the time when describing changes in vegetation and when we describe the study area in which we're working, we always refer to this particular work of Mike's and Bobby's. So we have 9 major biomes. They're grouped largely according to the major life forms that occur there, so trees, grasses, shrubs, and so on. So the savannas would be predominantly made up of trees and grasses, the grassland dominated by grasses, the Nama Karoo, low dwarf shrubs, succulent Karoo, succulent shrubs, and so on. Secondarily, they're defined by the climate which exists in the area. So they attempt to sort of group different areas according to major life forms and climate. And we have 9 of these biomes in South Africa. And I'm going to be talking about some of them and use the terminologies that we see in this particular map. So I'll talk about the succulent Karoo, I'll talk about forest, about fynbos, about the Nama Karoo, grasslands, savannas, and so on. So this is a major initial organizing principle. It didn't stop here. Mike continued, of course. Mike was my boss at some point in my career. Wonderful guy, just retired last year and is now living in the UK. But he continued, and we had a European colleague visit us, Latsa Mochina, and together with just about the entire ecological community, botanical community, they developed this, what we would consider to be the Bible of South African vegetation. This tremendous book called The Vegetation of South Africa, Lesotho and Swaziland, which describes a number of different vegetation types grouped within the biomes. There's a CD, you can browse it, and you can buy it at the Kirstenbosch bookstore for several hundred rand, but it's a fantastic purchase. It's got great detail, the culmination really of centuries of work on the vegetation of South Africa. All the different regions, sub-regions, vegetation types mapped in beautiful colors, described, lots of text, and you can go anywhere in the country, look at the roadmap, and you'll know exactly where you are in terms of the vegetation, flip to the text, and you can have a long list of species and the major climate that defines it. And it really is a wonderful piece of work that is the envy of many colleagues across the world. So thanks, Mike and Lacho, for putting this together. So, while we don't use those earlier maps necessarily that the first botanists put together, like Harry Bolus and Paul Evans and so on, what we do use and can use is an amazing set of historical photographs which they took along their journeys. So here is a photograph from the late 1800s by Jurgens, actually a member of the Mountain Club of South Africa, on the top of the Drakensberg. So we have pictures from the top of the Drakensberg, from the top of Table Mountain, when it was fashionable to walk up the mountain in a blazer and a dasher, as we, or a boater, as we used to call it. Or we have these wonderful pictures, for example, of the Dyser River Valley at Hout Bay, before it became built up and developed and so on. So at the back there you see, Orange Kloof, of course, with these forest patches. I'll show you another picture of this later, but these little forest patches. You see Palmit dominating this wetland on the bottom through which the Dyser River Valley flowed. Of course, looks nothing like that today. So we have these wonderful insights, and I don't know, you've probably come across Vincent van Fraan's work, the Cape Town Then and Now book, and he publishes a paper weekly in the Weekend Argus, I think, which he shows these comparisons between different parts of Cape Town, some of which include a landscape photograph. We have these wonderful historical photographs that can be used, and I've been working with this historical collection of photographs for about 25 years now. So I finished my PhD in 1989, and I was very fortunate to have a wonderful mentor in Richard Cowling, a younger Richard Cowling. After I finished my PhD in 1989, I had a year to sort of kick around. And so I was employed by what's now the National Research Foundation to work on a compilation that was going to be published in the South African Journal of Science all about global change. It had just sort of emerged on the world stage as a major research theme, and South Africa wanted to be at the forefront of this wave, and they identified a number of key research topics that we could work on. And so because of my PhD, which was in the Sandage River Valley and in the Nama Karoo near Graaffreinet, I was tasked with trying to answer this simple question. Has the Karoo expanded? Is the Karoo expanding? Is this fact or is this fiction? And that's a picture of me on the bottom left, in case you didn't recognize it. I'm sure all the guys, or some of the guys in the audience, have got a picture like this stuck away in their family album somewhere. So I had a wonderful year working with Richard after my PhD, and he continued to mentor me through this process. And we tried to answer this particular question. And I was amazed in the process. I came across a few photographs. I started to become familiar with the collections at the Pretoria Archives, where the Botanic Garden is situated. And this is Paul Evans' photograph from 1925. And I was quite amazed that these early pictures weren't showing pristine, ungrazed, lots of cover, the kind of landscapes I would have imagined to be in the early days. Instead, I was seeing landscapes that were very heavily utilized, poor cover, poor species composition, and sort of signs of degradation, desertification, as I understood it then. And when I retook the photographs, I was seeing time and again an image, instead of showing conditions that were worse off, I was seeing conditions that were better off. So I argued in that paper that, in fact, it was fictitious to suggest that the Karoo was still expanding into the Free State grasslands in the northeastern parts of the country. And this was a very real concern that had emerged in the 1950s by John Acox. And John had a formidable knowledge of plants, and he traveled very widely in this country, covering tens, if not hundreds of thousands of miles, as it was in those years. And John could get out of the car almost anywhere in the country, and in one of his big black notebooks in beautiful copper plate handwriting, write down all the species that he could see over a period of, over a distance of 2 or 3 kilometers. He had a phenomenal memory, a phenomenal knowledge of plants. And those he didn't know, he would collect and send to Pretoria for identification. And through this work, through looking into the felt for decades, John compiled his famous Felt Types of South Africa. And in this document, which guided us for decades, was a series of four maps. How South Africa was, how the vegetation was in the 1950s. Sorry, in AD 1400, which he considered to be a period when the vegetation was probably fairly pristine. How it was in 1950. And then you'll see later he predicted how it might be in 100 years from when he was publishing in the 1950s. And he argued what had happened was that the vegetation of South Africa was once the central parts dominated by sweet grass belts, The Nama crew was confined to the western parts, the succulent crew also confined to the west. And this coastal foreland was mostly forests that had subsequently been cleared. And what had happened was that because of heavy utilization, that the Nama crew grasslands had started to invade into the Free State grasslands. So the Nama crew shrublands, the dwarf shrubs that are typically associated with the Karoo, the kind of landscapes you see as you leave Laingsburg and before you get to Bloemfontein, those sort of landscapes were expanding in a north-eastwards direction into the grasslands because of heavy utilization. So what was once a grassy landscape is now becoming a carroid Karoo dwarf shrubland landscape. And these shrubs were advancing to Pretoria. This was the great clarion call. And importantly also, in the vacuum left by the eastward expanding carroid shrublands, deserts were encroaching. This is this area over here. Deserts were encroaching. And this, John Aycox argued, was solely the result of poor utilization by settler farmers, by white farmers who held most of this land. Wasn't rainfall, because the evidence to that date was that rainfall and temperature and climate hadn't changed at all. So he argued it was purely as a result of poor utilization. And that if we continued in this way, we would in fact worsen the situation and see the desert environments expanding even further into the Free State grasslands and the carroid elements advancing even further. Not only into the Free State, but also into the Kalahari and into the areas above Kimberley. But he worked very hard for much of his career also in developing appropriate scientific management approaches to how to restore these landscapes and get things back to what they once looked like. So John's work had a very important influence on the Department of Agriculture in particular, and they worked hard to bring in programs like the stock reduction scheme, like farm planning. They had all their resource conservation technicians working with farmers to educate farmers to better plan their farms and reverse the situation that John Aycox predicted would happen if it continued in the same way. So I've continued to try and pursue my early work from the late 1980s and ask a few simple questions. So one of the things I do in my research career, it's not the only thing, but it's certainly an important part of my research focus, is to try and find out how has the vegetation of South Africa changed, and then why? What are the main drivers of this change? And then to try and get some sense of the wider lessons of this understanding. And I use repeat ground photography as a main tool, but I try and combine this with reading these historical travelers' records, people like Robert Jacob Gordon, some of you might have read his work, François Le Vaillant, it's very important, Birchall, and so on. So all these early documents, Sparman, Anders Sparman, and so on. Then we have a good collection of aerial photographs as well for South Africa from about the 1920s, 1930s, depending where you are in the country. And more recently, we have remote sensing. So these are satellite-borne sensors that circle the Earth, and they give you information at a large scale about what's going on in the country from about the 1980s. And we use geographical information systems, computerized systems, to map and understand what's going on. But the core of our work is field surveys. It's understanding the plants, understanding the flora, understanding what's going on. Each species has got information for you. If there's an abundance of this species, it says something about what's happened to this land over time. If there are lots of babies of this one, then you can interpret that. You can read something into the landscape, using all your ecological skill to interpret why something has happened and the trajectory into where it's going into the future. So this is where all the skill comes in, where all the decades of learning come in, to try and understand the trajectories of change using the fieldwork. You also count trees, especially aloes, big aloes, the kookaburras, the quiver trees, and cedars from the cedar bird, to try and get a sense also of how things are changing. And then we do some modeling, not me really, but my colleagues try, so that's good. And this has involved many students over many years, and Rick Rohde, my colleague at the bottom there, has been very influential in helping me and thinking through some of the results, but we've had many students involved in these projects. So what I want to do is, these are the sites that we've managed to re-photograph to date. So we visited about 1,300. The dot looks very big on the map, but in reality it's a very small area, I promise you. I wish we did cover such an area. But each dot represents a site that we visited where there is an historical photograph, and we've retaken the photograph and tried to interpret the changes. So we've done about 1,300. We've got about another 10, 12, 13,000 to go. More about that later. I'm running out of time, that's for sure. So I want to take you on a journey from the Namib to the Cape, and then again into Middelburg and into the eastern parts of the country, the subtropical coasts around Durban and so on. So let's start in the Namib Desert. So here's a photograph taken by William Coates Palgrave in 1876, or his photographer in 1876, so that's what, nearly 140 years ago, in the Swakop River, and it shows tremendous stability over time. So you see some tall acacia areolobas, the camel thorns still there, you see salvadoras. Very similar, not much has happened to this landscape. You don't see any evidence of desertification or drying out or things are getting worse. Further south, in the Gurib little river area, again, long time series, very little has actually happened to this landscape. Acacias, acacia karoo in this case, confined to more or less the same places, more or less the same abundance. There's been no major flooding that's occurred in this area to transform this particular site. Further south, Dubis near Helmeringhausen, we see this already fairly old acacia areoloba, this old camel thorn. These acacia habicladas, I think they're called candlestick acacias or candle thorns or something like that. And we see that same acacia still there, looking a little bit the worse for wear. He's clearly getting a bit tired, but he's still there. He's actually shrunk a little bit. And we see a landscape full of grass now, but that's a very ephemeral component that comes and goes depending on the seasons, and we happen to be there at a very good time. But the landscape, again, is not something that's heavily degraded or changed. We wouldn't raise the alarm with the Namibian government about the condition of the vegetation based on this set of photographs. The Bukaros crater, some of you might know that, driving to Windhoek, again, very stable landscape, same species occurring in the same drainage channels at more or less the same abundances. Again, we wouldn't argue that too much has been happening in that particular area over these last century or so. Okay, so that's the dry parts of Namibia. What's going on in the wetter parts, I'll show you later, but for the dry parts, we argue for quite a stable landscape. What about Namaqualand? Here we have about 300 photographs from Namaqualand, and one of the things that I want to introduce now is this idea that land tenure, the way in which land is used and governed, is very important for the changes that we see. So Namaqualand, you may or may not be aware, also had a series of communal areas, much like the former homelands and self-governing territories in the eastern part of the country, the former Transkei, Siskei, Venda, and so on. Namaqualand also had a series of communal areas, these so-called colored reserves, Lelyfontein, Komaha, Steinkop, Concordia, and so on, into which about 45% of the population have lived over the last century or more. In fact, they were set up in the early 1800s by the then chief of the Nama-speaking Khoi herders to try and protect, that he wanted to protect some land for his communities. And they've kept their sort of basic structure since then. People use the land very differently in communal areas as they do in private farms. And this has an impact on the vegetation. As you see at this fence line contrast on the left-hand side, a privately owned farm, very low stocking rates. This fence was set up in the 1960s. And since then, there's been this recovery. It used to be very similar across both sides of the fence. At least that's what we think from aerial photographs. But the left-hand side has got very low stocking rates, whereas the right-hand side has had to support 20 times the number of people over the years. And as a result, you see the vegetation has changed. You have a loss of perennial plants and a shift towards semi-toxic and annual plants. So how the land is managed has important implications for the kind of changes that you see in the vegetation. No one's blaming the people on the right, but they have been subject to some of the worst social engineering and racial-based policies of any communities in the world. But on the privately held land, they reflect relatively, like in Namibia, very little change in the vegetation. So we see here a landscape near Lurisfontein, same species, same density, same cover as occurred in the 1920s. Not far away again, in fact a slight improvement, there was more bare ground. What you can do in the analysis, you can zoom right in, we have good scanners and we can take our repeat photographs at very high resolution, and you can zoom right in using computer programs and you can measure and map and quantify the extent of bare ground that is in the two different images. And you see here improved cover, better vegetation composition probably than the early site. In the river areas, this is Margaret Levins's picture on the left, taken in 1932, just south of Van Reinsdorp in the Vido River. And we see repeated in many of the river areas an increase in thorn trees, in Acacia Karoo, across much of the Makoland. Probably as a result of the people aren't using firewood anymore. People don't graze as heavily with their livestock along these river channels as they used to. On the margins, we see what were open lands, what were heavily grazed, lots of daisies because of the disturbance. We see they now have become waving grasslands, sort of bushman land grasses, stipogrostis grasses, dominating the landscape today. So there we see a shift to something which is very different from the past and certainly not in the direction of increased degradation. Here's a site near Springbok in the Gugab Nature Reserve, which was declared in 1979. So the top picture shows a landscape very heavily utilized, heavily grazed and probably plowed, was protected from grazing, and we see the recovery in the perennial component of the vegetation over this period of time. And that's a response that is repeated at many sites in the Makoland. You protect it for long enough, and it does start to recover. But you need to protect it from this heavy utilization. The communal areas haven't fared as well. They have been heavily utilized by large numbers of people trying to make a living, usually in a subsistence fashion. And this site near Kubus shows a landscape that has some cover on it, but was subsequently, after this picture from Peter Carstens in the 1960s, was occupied by a number of stock posts. And so we see a landscape which one could argue is in a trajectory of degradation and desertification. We could argue this is not as good as it used to be. Not all communal areas exhibit this sort of response, but there's a higher degree of sites, a greater proportion of sites showing that in the communal areas for reasons of much more intensive land use. What we also see in the Makoland is an abandonment of cultivation, particularly on the privately held farms, because it's expensive and yields aren't great because of the generally low rainfall. And so farmers reckon it's not worth it. So they have abandoned, especially the marginal environments, they've abandoned quite a number of old fields. And so you find sites like this, which once held these beautiful displays of daisies because of the disturbance of the plow, they've now been abandoned, no longer plowed. And so you find a landscape which is now starting to have perennials coming in, Lebekias and so on, and you have a suppression of these annuals. So these big displays that were once right across the Makoland are confined to smaller and smaller parts of the region now. So this spring, we've got to get to the Makoland. Might be a diminishing phenomenon. So why has all this happened? There's no change in rainfall. Many studies have looked at rainfall in this area over the last 100, 150 years. No change in rainfall, no significant change. What we do see, though, is in the private lands anyway, a drop in the numbers of animals that are being held. So the Karakul sheep industry sort of topped around the 1960s and shifted to either to Dorpers and a more commercial operation around meat production, and goats have been in decline for much longer. So there's been this decline in livestock numbers, which we argue is the reason why we see this response in the vegetation. We also see in this graph here changes in cultivated areas. Just look at the red line, and at the bottom is from 1910 to the late 1980s. And the other lines are different types of crops, wheat, barley, oats, and rye, and so on. But the red line is the accumulated total, and that axis is on the right-hand side. But the general thing to have a look at is It's more or less stable, going up maybe. It peaks around 1970s and then falls away. So cultivated fields, not only do we see it in the photographs, but we also see it in the data that we get from the census records. Cultivated fields have been abandoned and are in decline. So we often try and triangulate what we see in the photographs with other evidence, such as the census data. Okay, so that's the Macwilan. Generally stable, improving, more cover in the in the privately owned farms. Communal areas, perhaps, slight decrease, getting worse. But not everywhere. No great cause for huge alarm anyway. So I want to shift now to the Cape Peninsula and talk about a study that was that we've been working on here. So this, you might know, Bloemfontein Ravine. It's at the, just below the cable station and below the 12 Apostles. This was just when the pipe track was being built. And we see a landscape quite open. Look at all the boulders that you can see, all the white boulders that you can see. Low cover, mostly grassy, not too many proteas, not too many ericoid shrubs, not too many erica shrubs. But low grassy type things, a lot of bulbs, restios, grasses and so on. And look how it's changed since 1888. It's quite remarkable, actually. So now we see a forest, or forest precursor species, dominating this landscape. You can't see the boulders anymore, really. And it is a closed canopy. If you try and go up, okay, the Bloemfontein Ravine Trail, you will probably know has been closed. But you try and walk up there, and it's actually very dense. There was nothing like that in 1888. And close up, you can see on the left, that's Castile Poort, just a few kilometers further along the pipe track. You can see again the same story, all these old, large boulders, you can see them in abundance in the early photograph, and today they're covered over with these forest and forest precursor species, phylicas, podalirias, oleas, and so olives and so on. I don't know what it's done to the water. Today there's a good stream flow. But probably last year is not a good indication of an average year in Cape Town. Zoe's done, master's student Zoe Poulsen has done some wonderful work, and this is her photograph. Well, this isn't hers, this was from the Cape Archives. In the early 1900s, this is Orange Kloof, so this is above Hout Bay. What you can see here is very well-defined boundaries between forest and fynbos. Can almost stand, put 1 foot in forest and put 1 foot in fynbos. There's a tremendous difference between the two. Very well confined and very well defined boundaries between forest and fynbos. Quite open, burnt frequently for grazing, and now today we see the boundaries are very diffuse. There's very little, you can't really know when you're moving from forest to fynbos. So there's been an extension and expansion of forest and forest precursor species in Orange Kloof over time. And what Zoe has done as part of her MSc, which she graduated in December last year, is to visit every forest patch, there's something like 180 of them on the Cape Peninsula, and she visited each one, but she also mapped using a 1944 aerial photograph and a 2008 repeat aerial photograph, and then she mapped every forest patch and she documented the extent of change in forest cover using these aerial photographs. So this is the Cape Peninsula. That's, of course, Table Bay. That's Signal Hill, Lion's Head. This is that Bloemfontein Ravine section I was telling you about. Orange Kloof. This has got to be Cecilia, I think, and this must be Kirstenbosch, Newlands Forest, Constantiaberg, Tokai, Noordhoek, and Noordhoek Peak is over here, Hout Bay, and so on. So the orange represents an expansion of forest between 1944 and 2008. The green is stable, no change. And there are a few little patches here of blue where you can see that forest cover has actually decreased. But the overarching or the overwhelming sort of view you get here is either green or orange. So they either stay the same or has expanded. These are indigenous forests. These are not plantation forests. So Zoe argued for a 65% increase since 1944. And her hypothesis is that it's best explained by the release from the very frequent fires that were occurring in the 18th and 19th centuries in the Cape Peninsula. Neville Pillins, of course, after whom, a botanist after whom Allopilansii comes, wrote, he delivered a presentation at the Big Fire Conference in 1924, published in the South African Journal of Science, and argued that fire return intervals were something like, on average, 3 years over much of the fynbos region. So people were burning the land very frequently, largely for livestock production. They were grazing animals here, and they wanted to keep the vegetation short, vigorous, and so they were just burning all the time. In some cases, he argued, every year where the vegetation could sustain it. So it's this release from these very heavy burning regimes that has resulted in this increase in forest cover. So that's what's going on in the Cape Peninsula. Surprisingly, I was quite surprised by Zoe's work. The penultimate area I want to look at is the Nama Karoo. So this is a very wide ecotone where a colleague of mine, James Gambiza, and then a student, Leonard Masubulele, who just graduated in 2012 with his PhD, now working for the South African National Parks. Leonard looked at a number of sites, all the way from De Wetstorp, Wepena, and then all the way down through to Aberdeen, Garfranet, state level, and so on. So this very large ecotone between the Nama Karoo and the Free State grasslands. Nama Karoo in the west and the Free State grass. This is the area that John Aycox was concerned about. This is where all the dynamism was happening, the transitions from one to the other, the movement of the Karoo shrublands into the Free State grasslands. So Leonard went and found a whole bunch of old photographs, and we went and re-photographed these sites. And John Aycox was quite correct, of course. He had every reason. He wasn't making it up. There was good evidence for the expansion of the Karoo shrublands into the Free State grasslands, as evidenced by this photograph right on the Lesotho border at Wepena. So here you see a whole bunch of Karoo shrubs dominating this landscape. Chrysocoma ciliata, the bitterbush, very abundant in this landscape. But when we went back in 2009, it's nothing like that at all. Grasslands now dominate, and you don't see these Karoo shrubs in as much abundance at all as you once used to see. Other sites like near Tarkastad, what were once completely dominated by Karoo shrubs. Rosemary bush, I think it's called, Areocephalus, Wallafridas and Pensias, which were dominant in that early landscape, as evidenced by John Aycox's field notes. They're hardly present in the landscape anymore. Instead, we have grasses which dominate. The other thing to see in this particular site is the expansion of acacias, where they were confined in the past to these narrow river channels in the distant part of the image at the bottom of the valley, or by the bottom of the plain, where they've now escaped, and they're now occurring also on the plains, and they've jumped out of that river stream. Typical Karoo felt in 1971 in a photograph taken by John Aycox, just south, 11 kilometers south of Middelburg. And today, wonderful grasses are occurring there. And it has been like this for several years now. So why has the Karoo become more grassy? Again, there's a sense that livestock numbers have declined. This is what the census data suggests. People aren't stocking with as many animals as they used to, largely because of stock reduction schemes, a greater environmental awareness, a sense of the importance of getting animals to the market as quickly as possible, in which case you need high quality animals. So you're much more business oriented, and for that you need high quality vegetation. And so stocking with fewer animals gives you higher quality animals, which gets them to market more quickly. There's also the idea that they might have... What if I close this? Will it? There's also a sense that climate has changed. Not in terms of the amount of rain, but when rain falls. So Justin de Toy, who works at Middelburg, has done a very extensive analysis of the climate record, and he shows that rainfall is falling earlier than it used to in the 1960s and 70s. So we're having more rain in early summer, which grasses do better. Grasses do better with early summer rain. Shrubs do better with late summer, early autumn rain. And that was the rainfall pattern in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, it seems. And now we're seeing a shift towards more early summer rain, which Justin argues is one of the reasons why we see better vegetation condition. The final area that I'd like to focus on is the eastern part of the country. This is James Pattick, a PhD candidate in our department, who's done some wonderful work, taken 300 photographs plus in the eastern parts of the country, traveled extensively from the Eastern Cape all the way up to his main focus, which is going to be the Tugela River Valley, repeating all these historical photographs in grasslands, in forests, in savannas, and documenting and trying to quantify the extent of change. And what he shows in this graph is that, so the bottom is the percentage woody cover change per decade. And on the left axis is the percentage of photographs, essentially, which show this change. So about a third, 30 rough percent, roughly percent, show either no change or woody cover has in fact decreased in the comparative estimate. So about a third show no change or decrease, but two-thirds show an increase in woody plant cover over time, sometimes as much as 15% per decade. Now that's a lot of change in the vegetation. And you can see it in the photographs. Here's a site near East London, a farm that's heavily utilized, a working farm, cultivated fields on the bottom in the foreground, cultivated fields just across the river. And also here, look at this site here, a forest patch or a woodland patch. Again, very well defined, very well bounded, because farmers were burning and using that area for grazing. This is in the 1920s. 2011, cultivated fields have almost fallen away, which is what has been happening over large parts of the eastern part of the country, particularly in the former communal areas. So this is all now woody plants, and there's those very narrowly well-defined forest patches are now, again, they've spread out over into the former grassland areas, and we see this repeated in many photographs as well. Here's this wonderful photograph from Paul Evans, Iltate Paul Evans, near Queenstown, which shows cycads in the foreground, aloe, ferox here on the slopes, and a few scattered acacia trees on the distant plains. Beautiful landscape around Queenstown. And this is James's picture from 2011. Cycads are still there, aloes are still there, but those background plains are now dominated by woody elements, mostly acacias. And after the acacias come a succession of other broadleafed shrubs and trees to make up a thicket, more of a thicket vegetation. Here also, just across the Kai River, so in the former Transkei area, this land in 1957, in this photograph taken by John Acox, very heavily utilized by people who were living in the area. People over here, they were cultivating their fields, they were subsisting on what they would produce. That's all changed, people are no longer doing that as much. Many of these old fields have now been abandoned. And when they get abandoned and aren't cultivated anymore, so thicket vegetation comes in over a very short space of time. And this again is repeated in many, many old fields across the former Transkei and KwaZulu-Natal areas. This rate of bush encroachment increase is quite rapid. So here's Commons' picture near King Williamstown, and then my picture from 1993, and then James went in 2011, and you can see the slow but steady increase in woody plant thickening at a site such as this. You don't have to be in the eastern part of the country. I said I'd come back to Namibia. Now this is near Okahanya, and here you can see the Central Highlands. You can see also in Namibia, the former the savanna areas too have experienced a thickening of vegetation, primarily by acacias in the savannah. This is one of the most important phenomena that is happening in southern Africa, is this woody plant increase. The old Boer War site, Magersfontein, 15th of December 1899, when so many young British soldiers and several Boer soldiers also lost their lives. Only because the landscape was open and the Boers sitting in the... I hope is this the right one. Okay. Only because the Boers were sitting in the trenches and could easily target the British soldiers. And today, it wouldn't have been so easy. Today, it's a woodland, certainly on the base, and you can see also how the back mountains have changed as well. So there is very little cover on these back mountains. Now it's full of Tarkananthus camphoratus, dense thickets. Why has bush encroachment occurred? Well, there's a fierce and interesting debate between a number of different academics trying to find out why. Grazing by sheep and cattle certainly are important. They graze the grasses, they remove the competition for trees, and so what happens then is that the woody plants are able to get in. Goats, on the other hand, love trees. They nibble away at the small individuals, they keep them down, and they keep them from getting away and from starting to dominate. People aren't harvesting wood fuel as much as they used to. That certainly needs to be taken into account. We've spoken about land abandonment. Fire. People used to burn southern African landscapes. You won't believe how important fire was for the early farming practices across the country. Rainfall. We mentioned something about Middelburg, about change in seasonality. The overall change in rainfall, generally people argue, hasn't changed that much. Temperature's certainly gone up. This would favor woody plants because frosts knock them back a bit. But several of my colleagues emphasize the important role that carbon dioxide enrichment has played, because CO2 favors trees, especially because of their particular photosynthetic pathway. It favors them over grasses. They're able to conserve more water, they grow faster, and they're able to get away from the fires if you were to fire the vegetation in the first place. So the argument is that CO2 enrichment is having a major impact. We've gone from 180 parts per million to 400 parts per million in just 120 odd years. So we've really more than doubled our CO2 levels, and this has had an impact on woody plant encroachment. Recent analyses of a long-term experiment in Alice, which Winston Trollope, the doyen of fire ecology in savannas, he's had these experiments of 1 hectare plots that he's burnt once. Some is burnt once a year, some is burnt every 2 years, some is burnt every 3 years, some he hasn't burnt. And the analysis from this work suggests that CO2 is very real and is important, but it clearly interacts with other elements. And this is why it's so difficult to try and get a sense of change and why things are happening. So what can we learn? Land use is important, but it interacts also with global drivers such as CO2, and it's difficult to separate out these two. State intervention is important. Farmer support programs do make a difference, but they need to be tailored to the objectives and management practices of end users. It doesn't help to roll out commercially orientated intervention programs for communal area farmers. It's not going to work. And that is what's been happening in many of our land reform programs. Finally, repeat photographs provide a good record of change, I feel. They're able to test these past predictions like John Aycox's and form a benchmark against which future change can be evaluated. Okay, so what of the future? You've probably been to several of these talks at summer school, but it is a catastrophic future is projected for Southern Africa. There's no question about that. Hotter, drier, especially in the western parts, aridification, contraction of the biomes to something that we haven't experienced in the past. Our global circulation models suggest, in this diagram over here, increases in temperature across most of Southern Africa, and decreases in rainfall. The brown signifies a decrease in rainfall, except for East Africa, maybe an increase in rainfall. But certainly, western parts of South Africa are going to get hotter and drier. So we have these models, these models based on the GCMs that suggest that this is where we are in terms of the biomes today. This might be where we're going to head. These were the very early projections, and they were arguing for contraction of the biomes, much like John Aycox was suggesting, but now it's climate-driven, not land-use-driven. It's since been toned down a little bit as new evidence has become available about climate projections and so on. So now we're sitting with the most recent scenarios, which aren't quite as dramatic for the winter rainfall region. But it sparked, of course, a whole number of publications such as the heat is on, and then Leonie Joubert's work on scorched and boiling point, warning of the dangers of climate change. But I think these repeat photographs are important for us to be able to measure, to monitor the extent and the rate and where and why these changes are happening across the country. So that's why these next steps are critical for this particular program, this particular research endeavor that I've been busy with. So we're trying to broaden our network. I mentioned to you we've taken 1,300, we've got several thousand still to go, and that I'm running out of time. So the idea was that we would utilize interested people like yourself, skilled people like yourself, who have a fascination for our country and want to know and find out what's going on. Les Underhill, a colleague of mine in the department, is the master of all this citizen science work, and his animal demography unit has done some wonderful work. And he has Les reporting back to his group of citizen scientists. Some of you might be part of his team. So we want to try and make these historical photographs more easily available on the internet, and then start to attract citizen scientists to try and get involved in re-photographing. I see a number of you writing down the website. That's wonderful. It's not functional yet. It's going to be. This year is critical. We're trying to really work at it this year to try and make it all happen. So this is what SABAP's done. I'm nearly finished. So here's Les's. He's got, I think, thousands of people counting birds, mapping birds. And this is a map, for example, of changes between the SABAP 1 in 1990 and SABAP 2, which is still current. And the brown areas are changes in cisticolas, weavers, and bulbuls. And Les thinks this is altered because of bush encroachment, that they're responding to this change, to the changes in their habitat. And so we're trying to put our different ideas together and work together to try and get a sense of what's been going on. So this is our ReFoto South Africa project. As I mentioned, we're trying to get people involved and look forward to your participation as soon as we can get this all working and up and running. So watch the space, and please, be nice to interact with you in the years ahead. Thank you.
We do have 5 minutes left for questions, so you're welcome to ask any.
Yeah? Tim, you haven't mentioned the role played by the periodic flash floods, which we did. You had a few this summer already. That changes the landscape.
Yes, indeed. We obviously, part of the problem is that we are restricted to some extent by the pictures that we have. So if we don't have a photograph of, for example, a site where there has been a flash flood, like at Laingsburg or so on, it's very difficult for us to then go and monitor and show the changes that might have occurred as a result of the flash flood. So often they're quite narrowly, they influence a very small part of the landscape. And if we don't have the image, then it's very difficult for us to see what it was like. And that's really a study for those who work on sort of current impacts of land use and say hydrological changes and so on. So it's not really something which the repeat photographers have done a lot of work on.
Yes?
Did you know that's extremely many rains this season now? So next year or in 2 years we should see different.
The Karoo, you're saying?
Yeah, the Karoo.
Yes. Yes, the effects of those big rainfall events, unless they're sustained over several years, they're quite ephemeral. So you'll see grasses maybe or certain components of the vegetation coming up, but they won't be sustained over long periods. So one has to, that's one of the problems with these photographs, and I'm often asked, how do you control for season and for the kind of year that you've had? So you have to be aware of what's happened just before or around the last year or so when you go and repeat your photographs, so that you're not making a false interpretation based on what's relatively ephemeral and short-lived response in the vegetation.
Yes?
Have you done work on the northern parts of the country, like Mapungubwe area?
Yes, you would have noticed that there's quite a barrier along the Orange River for me. So I'm a Cape boy, so I haven't yet, for no real reason, I just don't cross the Orange that often. But that's a major thrust that I think this work involving citizen scientists really, that's what we're very excited about, is getting all the northern areas covered. Because we've got a wonderful collection, because Paul Evans was based in Pretoria, and many of them were based in Pretoria. So they, you know, they've got these great photographic collections from that area, and we really want to involve people from the north. So, let's hope.
I was wanting to ask about alien vegetation. Would it help to photograph alien vegetation in Orange Kloof, for instance? We've noticed it's increasing.
Yes, you know, aliens do throw a bit of a curveball. Not so much the tall trees, the gums and the pines and so on, Prosopis. You can just distinguish those in the photographs. But it's really the smaller things that really get you in the aerial photographs. I mean, in the ground photographs. So you have to combine your repeat photography with a lot of field work to try and make sure that you're able to differentiate between what's indigenous. The change in indigenous cover and change in alien cover. And it is, I mean, photographs are wonderful ways. One doesn't have to only use photographs from the 1920s. One can set up a monitoring program today using...
They don't seem to be clearing in Orange Kloof.
They will get around to it. My sense is this Working for Water program is pretty committed, certainly on the Cape Peninsula, and they will get there. There's a program, there's a long process that has to happen in order for them to get around. But it might be a good idea to find a spot that's comfortable for you, take a photograph, and come back every year, take the same photograph, and then write to Guy Preston, the director of Working for Water, with your set of photographs. That'll really get him going.
There's a question there, yes?
You've said nothing about
fynbos. Other than the forests and fynbos interactions. The fynbos is quite hard to use photographs with because they all look the same. But we have, from a photograph, you know, when you go and look at them, then of course they're not the same. They're wonderfully different.
But if you talk to John Manning, I mean, he's very pessimistic, and you're very positive.
Yes, that's true. What does that say about John and I? But we have done some work. Cape Point, for example. Hugh Taylor did this wonderful study in 1966, in which every kilometer, he did a 10 by 5 meter plot. And he measured all the plants, counted all the plants, and then he stood back and he took a photograph of that plot. And there are 100 plots in Cape Point. And Robin Powell, an MSc student, graduated in June last year, and her work is based on repeating all of Hugh's photographs. And, you know, in Cape Point, we don't see any evidence of dramatic decline, change. In fact, it's quite variable from site to site. Some areas have changed, but it's pretty stable. So I'm not, from that one little study, I'm not particularly alarmed. We've done some work in the Kurt-Winter Wilderness area as well. People were burning that place in the late 1800s and early 1900s. They were burning it as often as they could. And it's recovered because it's now a conservation area. It's been well looked after. The big impact on fynbos, of course, are aliens and clearing for cultivation. That's what's going on. Urbanization and development. Those are the big impacts. But in terms of the vegetation, when we see sort of indigenous pristine landscapes in early pictures, we don't see that they're degrading because of climate change or temperature increase at this point, anyway. We don't see that sort of thing happen. It's more land use that's being the big impact.
Okay, I think we end at this point. So thank you very much, Tim. And we see you all tomorrow.
Thank you.
Was it a record yet?
Very.
I don't want to bring too much today.
No. I think this is also very good hay. I mean, I was wondering, do you know the Ezekiel Museum collection?
I've been through it once or twice, not very thoroughly. I don't know.
Because I certainly know the paleontologists will have also bought it, and BPI, the Bernard Price Institute, they have also a huge collection.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine.
Friends of the
God, yes.